Welcome back to Book Club Appetizer. I'm your book-obsessed host, Abby, and this week, in honor of our podcast turning 1 year old, we have a very special guest co-host, Emma Schaefer. Welcome, Emma.
Hi, guys. I'm Emma. I'm the community manager of Blogging for Books. We give free review copies to bloggers in exchange for honest reviews. And be honest, who doesn't like free books?
No one I know. Thanks for joining us, Emma. We're bringing you another episode of our snackable podcast that's perfect for kicking off your book club meetings or enhancing those solo reading adventures.
I feel like often the most annoying thing about hosting book club is figuring out what to feed people. And that's what I love about Book Club Appetizer. You're taking the stress out of it by pairing each book with an awesome appetizer recipe.
And don't forget the cocktails.
I would never, ever forget the cocktails.
We find a good cocktail really helps to get the conversation flowing among your friends. Well, at least amongst those who've actually read the book, am I right?
You're totally right. However, in my book club, that's not necessarily everyone.
The novel we read this month takes place in 1950s Houston high society, so we felt our aperitifs and hors d'oeuvres had to be elevated as well. We're serving up roasted oysters with fresh cheese, and the best part is you don't even need to know how to open an oyster. Pop these babies in a 425-degree oven for 6 minutes, and they open perfectly on their own.
Yum. I love these. You top them with cheese and chives. Perfect. This recipe comes from the cookbook Fire and Ice, Nordic Cooking by Dara Goldstein, and I feel like she's a lady after my own heart, because the serving size for this dish is listed as many oysters as you and your friends can eat.
Yeah, yum. And this week's cocktail harkens back to the 50s in a big way. It's a sausage martini. Yes, you heard that right. It's a regular vodka martini, but instead of an olive or an onion, you pop a Vienna sausage in there. It sounds weird, but we promise it's delicious. So thanks to our friends at Tastebook for both of those recipes.
Thanks, Tastebook. Okay, you know how this works. Abby and I recap a book we've recently loved, and then bring the author into the studio to do a quick reading and answer our most pressing questions. But before we go any further, consider this your official warning. This podcast contains plot spoilers.
Yes. And this month we read The After Party by Anton D. Sclafani, which centers on two women, Joan Fortier and Cece Buchanan. These women are Texas socialites. They're surrounded by oil money, they're decked out in silks and diamonds, and their photos appear in the newspaper gossip columns anytime they're snapped leaving the glitzy Shamrock Hotel.
Joan and Cece have known one another since they were girls and are best friends despite their major differences. Joan is tall and blonde and strong-willed. She's always been the one to buck tradition, and when she walks into a room, all the heads swivel in her direction. Cece, on the other hand, is the steady one, the one who plays by the rules and the one who fades into the background behind Joan.
When the girls were younger, Cece was Joan's partner in crime, but now that the women have grown up, she feels more like her chaperone. Joan isn't interested in fitting into a woman's pre-assigned role in the male-dominated world of 1950s Houston. She has an appetite for more than being a wife and mother, which confuses and frustrates Cece because she is both of those things. Joan lusts after entirely different things, and her refusal to fit into the mold feels dangerously subversive to her best friend.
Right. Cece has always followed Joan around, picking up the pieces, making sure she gets out of scrapes and gets home safely. This novel looks at the true complexity of female friendship. These women are navigating their dreams and keeping their secrets hidden, all while trying to carve out some small piece of identity. And their paths are diverging due to the choices they make as adults. So, at some point, the friendship turns a bit toxic. Have you ever had a friendship like that?
You know, I have had friendships that turn into one-way streets where one person is just taking from the other and never giving in return, sort of like an emotional vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I think, really, the most loving thing to do with a friend like that is just to extricate yourself and let each other go, which Cece has to learn to do with Joan.
Totally. And you know, one of my other favorite aspects of this book is Dee Sclafani's incredible setting of the scene. As I was reading, I kept feeling like I was in the Shamrock, hearing the swish of taffeta dresses, smelling the wafting cigarette smoke, and being blinded by the diamonds on all of the women.
Yes, and, you know, I remember feeling that way when I was reading her first book, The Yanalasi Riding Camp for Girls, which I adored. And it's set, as you might expect, at a riding camp for girls high in the Blue Ridge Mountains and set in 1930. And as I read that book, I could practically smell the leather of the saddles hanging in the barn.
Awesome. Anton writes such multifaceted characters as well. These women are so interesting, and their flaws feel familiar and contemporary, even though both of her novels are historical fiction.
Oh, that's such a good point, Emma. Okay, so next up, Anton Di Sclafani joins me in the studio to talk female friendship and how far, or not, women's rights have come since the 1950s. Stay tuned.
This episode of Book Club Appetizer is brought to you by Blogging for Books. If you love to blog about what you read, this site is for you. They provide free review copies of books in exchange for your honest reviews. It's easy to sign up, so head on over to bloggingforbooks.com and join today.
Welcome to another episode of Book Club Appetizer. I'm here with Anton Di Sclafani, the author of The After Party and the Yanalasi Riding Camp for Girls. Is that
Yanalasi? I mean, you can say it like five different ways, but that is good.
Good. Okay. So your first book, which I absolutely loved, The Yanalasi Riding Camp for Girls, is also a work of historical fiction, just like The After Party. Why are you drawn to writing in that genre?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And thank you for the compliment about Yanalasi. It's instinctive that I want to write about historical periods. It's when I started Yanalasi, I was 23 years old, and I wasn't really thinking about how the book would sell or who it would be marketed to or anything. I just wanted to set a book in the 20s. It just kind of came to me as part of the story. And then for The After Party, I was really interested in this hotel called the Shamrock. And so I wanted to write about this place, and the 50s are just really glamorous and the clothes are really amazing, and historical fiction just seems so much more interesting to me than contemporary life. I am not a history buff. I'm not, I mean, this sounds bad, but I'm somebody who knows very little about history. Like, I don't consider myself an amateur historian who writes historical fiction. But the pressures that you can put on characters in history is just so compelling.
Do you think, you know, that there are things that a historical setting can do for your plot lines and show your readers that contemporary can't?
Yes. I mean, I think that there are many books that write great plots that have great plots and that involve text messaging, but it's like, kill me now. Like, if I had to write a book that involved text messaging, it would be awful. Yes. In this book, for instance, the characters are not easily reachable. I mean, you can only call each other on a telephone. Private lines are a new thing. Characters are not immediately available to each other. So there's that part of it that works on the plot. But then it's also just really interesting. I mean, I write about women, and the world for a woman in 1957 is just so radically different than, obviously, in a thousand different ways. But that part of it is the most interesting to me. Like, what is it like to be a woman in 1957?
Totally. And 1950s Houston was definitely a man's world. And
yes.
In one line that you write, as Cece watches her father drive away, she wonders that without him, quote, how would I move through the world? And I think this captures an important crux of the book, that women are expected to move through the world on the arm of a man, either their father or their husband. So what happens when Joan, the character that the book orbits around, tries to buck this convention when she wants to have a little bit of power and prerogative in her own life?
I mean, I think her world kind of collapses. It is mean, I think that you're absolutely correct that the women could not navigate that world without a man, especially, I mean, women in all social classes, but in this social class, I mean, you had no social standing if you weren't attached to a man. There are upper class women in Houston and this exclusive neighborhood in River Oaks, Houston. And I wanted to see what was available to a woman who was not interested in being escorted around by a man. And I think that the world, what happened was pretty damning. I mean, the world was not kind to Joan as a woman who is not interested in getting married and having children. Yeah. And that was sad, but also exciting for me to explore.
Yeah, I was going to say Joan Fortier, the character that really the after party centers on, she is magnetic, I would say.
Thank you.
She's rich, she's elegant, she's sexy, she's poised, she's splashed across the gossip columns. Women and men alike want to be next to her. Was she a fun character to write? How did you get into her mindset?
She was a fun character to write. She was also a difficult character to write because there's something, I mean, she's incredibly charming and magnetic. And as with a lot of charming and magnetic people, they're also kind of enigmatic. Mm-hmm. And you don't quite know what's going on in, you know, inside. So it took me a couple of drafts to get into Joan and to understand Joan, even as the person who was writing about Joan. The book is told in first person, and it's narrated by Cece Buchanan, who is her best friend. So I was very much inside of Cece's head, but Joan also is kind of mysterious to Cece. I identified so much with Cece that I also found Joan kind of mysterious. But she was really, I mean, she's a beautiful character. She can wear anything. She's very wealthy. She's not interested in clothes, so she has people dress her. And her father buys her all of these ridiculous jewels. So that was really fun. I mean, that was just like pure pleasure to write about.
Exactly.
To page through old Vogues and to look at jewelry from the, I mean, I love antique jewelry, and to have a limitless budget and clothe her and put any kind of jewelry on her that I wanted to. And also just to write about somebody that everybody wants to look at.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah. So a lot of this book, which we just sort of touched on, looks at the sometimes fickle nature of women's friendships, especially between Joan and her best friend, Cece.
Yes.
So then in their greater group of friends as well. Why is friendship between women simultaneously loving while also really thorny at times?
I do not know. that is a good. I never really had male friends. I had always had really close female friends. And then in graduate school, my best friends were two men, one straight man, one gay man. And I remember one day just thinking, like, it's so easy being friends with them. Like, they're not offended by things. Like, they're still my best friends. And I still have, I mean, I have female best friends, too. But I think that there's something about being close to another woman, especially when you're young, that is totally intoxicating. I mean, when I think of, especially, I mean, adolescence is really where it started for me, but being so close to a friend, knowing everything about them, I think it's impossible for there not to be a hierarchy of some sort, and especially when you're a teenager and you're judging yourself in all sorts of ways. And Joan and Cece were friends since birth, so they had all of this. I mean, they hung out when they were infants. They became friends when they were children. They have all this history, and I think the more history you have, the richer the friendship is, but the more complicated it is. Your original question, I don't know why female friendship is so thorny, but it is. Yeah. I mean, every woman who has a female friend
can
attest to it. But I think that it has something to do with the flip side of love. I mean, you are so invested in this person and you love this person so deeply, but there is also kind of an underside to that relationship that rears its head sometimes. And there are, you know, I think we've all had friendships end badly and then friendships that endure. And I don't know why some do and some don't. Yeah. But I was interested in that.
Well, and it's really interesting that, you know, Cece and Joan, they're born, they're brought up together, they're on the same path. And then at some point their paths diverge. And,
yes.
You know, when Cece senses Joan's disdain about the obvious next step of having children, Cece thinks to herself, I did want children. We all wanted children. We needed families or else we would float away. We needed homes to put them in. So Cece is very eager to stick to the status quo, the role she's been given in society and in life without challenging it. So why do you think Joan's challenging of the rules is so threatening to her and the other women in their circle?
I think it's always threatening when there is somebody in your circle who doesn't see the world the way that you do, or somebody that you respect that sees the world differently than you do. And these are things that, these are the most important things in Cece's life, her husband, her children. She is not somebody who wants to live a crazy, exciting life. I mean, she wants to be domestic and she wants to stay at home with her children. And Joan doesn't. And Cece finds it upsetting. Mm-hmm. And it's also I think it's hard to when people don't care about the same things that you do exactly, but you love them. It's hard to understand, like, why? Why aren't they the same way that I am? And I it was important to me too that I think it's easy as a modern reader to make Joan the hero because she's a woman who is not interested in being domestic and not interested in depending on a man. And Cece is interested in these things. So it was important to me that I was respectful of Cece and that she was a woman who was totally fine living in the 1950s. But the challenge to her the challenge to her character is, can she accept Joan not being fine with this world? And that's the struggle of the book. Can she see that another person could not be happy with the same things that she's happy with?
Well, and I would find my loyalties and sympathies switching from Joan to Cece in a matter of pages.
Good.
Like back and forth. One side I was siding with Joan on one page, and then the next I was siding with Cece. Was that your intention to really
make it? Yes, I'm glad you read it that way. Thank you. Thumbs up. Well, I didn't want one character to be right and the other character to be wrong. I didn't want the story to be Cece's story and Joan to be the person interfering with her plans. I wanted it to be a real struggle. I mean, I think that's the complicated thing about any relationship, any close relationship, even good relationship. I mean, a good marriage, a good friendship, anything, is that you know, there is no right. There is no wrong. You're just in it and you love the other person. And especially with something like this, when there's a crisis to the friendship or a crisis to the relationship, there is no moral compass or moral center.
Yeah. So from the 1920s, when Jaana Lassi is set, to the 50s, which is the time period that the after party takes place, the societal rules for women have barely changed in that time period. You know, women are expected to maintain propriety at all times. No sex before marriage. Yeah. No children out of wedlock. You know, they must be ideal wives and mothers. Do you use these societal structures as foils for your female characters, things that they are automatically battling against, you know, just because of their gender from the get-go?
Yeah, well, Joan is automatically battling against it, but she doesn't know what she's battling against. Like, Joan and Cece, I mean, all women then would really have benefited from birth control, right? But the pill is not available to them. So that's the thing about writing historical fiction. Like, as a modern reader, you read about these characters and their blind spots are so incredibly clear to us, right? Like, when I was considering when to set the book, it had to be before The Pill came out, and it had to be before The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan was published, so that the things that they're struggling with do not have a name. And that was crucial because I mean, I could have written a book set in 1967, but it would have been a totally different book because they would have been fighting against things that they understood and that had a name. It was more interesting to me that those things didn't have a name, that they were, that the ways that Joan and Cece's lives were narrowed and squashed. I mean, squashed is maybe a dramatic verb, but that they didn't quite understand what they were fighting against. And I think that, I mean, who knows what, I mean, I could you know, list some things, but who knows what, in when people write historical fiction about 2016, like, who knows what our blind spots will look like? I mean, I feel like I know some of them, yeah. I think that's the fascinating thing about writing historical fiction is identifying the blind spots of people of the past. But it's also too easy to make caricatures of people because we know so much about them, and we know how dramatically Cece's world is going to change over the next 10 years. Jesus, it's going to change enormously. But then I talk to older women who lived in River Oaks and who were not, they were younger in the 50s than Joan and Cece's characters, but, you know, there's a way that their lives didn't change very much. I mean, they were married to oil men. They lived in River Oaks their entire lives, and all of this social change was happening, and they were kind of protected from it by money,
yeah.
and by living in a place that I mean, I don't want to say that time forgot, but that you know, wasn't interested in seeing and interacting with the world in a certain way. And there are pockets of those. I mean, there are places like that all over the country.
Yeah, but almost that the money created this wall where they didn't need to fight for anything.
No, really. And they weren't going to go to work. I mean, they weren't going to wear pants and go get a job. They weren't. I mean, and they weren't interested in that either.
Yeah.
You know, that which, I mean, I think there's this idea that you just automatically assume, like, everybody and every woman in Mad Men is unhappy and they want to get a job, and I mean, they're all unhappy in various ways, you know. But that, and I myself, I mean, I would be miserable if I were Cece and I was just expected to stay. I mean, I would be bored out of my mind if I had to stay home with children, full time. But I think that I think it's important to me to respect that there are women who want to stay home full time with children and want. And especially in that time period, they were there were women who liked that life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And my grandfather used to always say that the most important invention, in his opinion, in the 20th century was the pill.
Yes. Oh, yes.
It absolutely.
Yes.
Changed everything. And
yes, it's just the yes. And I mean, before the pill, it was just, I mean, that was what you had to have children and stay home.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, I mean, not. In certain, we're talking about like a set of women who were privileged enough that they did not have to work. But the pill, yes. I have so much to say about the pill.
Exactly. A modicum of agency, finally.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
In ways people didn't understand, like, immediately.
Right.
Yeah.
Which we're still.
Yes. Yes. And as pregnancy gets separated more and more from, I mean, it's not like quite separated, but I feel like, you know, in 20 years it will not be inconceivable that you don't need a woman to grow a child, and
right.
Then it's like, what'll happen then?
Exactly. Okay, so Anton, would you read us a
yes.
section?
It's the women who still ask me about Joan, young women who have stumbled upon her story and my part in it. Old women who used to admire her photographs in the gossip columns. Joan the Jewel, a glimmer on some man's arm. Frank Sinatra's, Dick Kruger's, Diamond Glenn's. They want to know who she was. First, I tell them she was Furlow Fortier's little blonde darling. From the very beginning, she was adored. Then she was Houston's most famous socialite. They won't ever know what it was like to stand in her presence, but I try to paint a picture. There wasn't anything subtle about Joan, a woman born to be looked at. She was slender, but she wasn't a twig. Her dresses clung to her, drew attention to her shapely hips, her strong arms, her famous bosom. Wherever she went, champagne flowed like a fountain. She made people happy. She was beautiful, certainly, but she was more. She was lit from the inside. I stop here. They want to know how she disappeared, but I can't tell them that. I don't say that loving her was my earliest instinct, my first memory. I was her best friend since infancy, her modern-day lady-in-waiting, her sister in all but blood. She disappeared for the first time in 1950 when we were seniors in high school. It didn't take us long to figure out that she had run away to Hollywood to become a star. And if you had stood in a room with her at that time, you would have been sure she'd make it. Because she was everyone's dream in those days. Why not some studio executives? She was gone for a year, trying, and then she returned, and life as we all knew it resumed its orbit, with Joan at the bright, hot center. She disappeared in 1,000 small ways after Hollywood. For a day, for an evening, for a week. Even when she was with me, it felt as if she were vanishing. It was the one constant in our friendship. She would leave and I would look for her, until I would not.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anton DiSclafani, author of The After Party. This has been so great to talk to you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening, readers. We have some reader questions on our site in addition to a link to the awesome Spotify playlist that we put together to accompany Anton's book. It's filled with 1950s greats like Frank Sinatra, Sam Cooke, Dinah Shore, and the Shirelles.
Pair the music with some oysters and a sausage martini, and you'll feel like you're seated for dinner alongside Joan, Cece, and the rest of their girlfriends at the Shamrock Hotel.
And if you liked The After Party and want to read more like it, the Read It Forward team has suggested a few recommendations on readitforward.com/podcast. Book Club Appetizer has monthly episodes centered on fantastic books that you should read with your book club. So keep reading with us. We'll even let you take all the credit at Book Club for picking such an awesome read.
And in exchange, we want to hear from you. Take a minute and leave us a review on iTunes and let us know what you think of our show. We would really appreciate it.
Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Read It Forward and tweet about books with us.
Happy reading and cheers!
Cheers!